Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Now, in our last podcast, me and Jack Howard started running down our top 10 David Fincher movies in order. He has a new movie coming out, Mank, which is his 11th movie. So in the run-up to the release of Mank, we decided to order the 10 movies he's made so far. In the first podcast, we did numbers 10 to 6. In this podcast, we're doing numbers 5 to 1. If you missed the previous podcast, don't worry. It's still there. You can download it at will. Anyway, on with the show. Now, look, this now brings us into the top five. I think we're progressing at a decent pace. So
I think we should push on.
Okay, so at number five, you have
Zodiac.
Wow. Okay. At number five, I have Gone Girl.
Okay. At number four, I have Gone Girl.
Okay, so we'll do that. And at number four, I have Fight Club. So we'll do Gone Girl first. You want to go first?
I absolutely adore Gone Girl. I think it might be one of the best cinema experiences I've ever had. And I mean that especially in a nostalgic way now, because the idea of being in a packed cinema where you can feed the energy off everybody is almost a foreign concept. That electricity that everyone had when we were watching Gone Girl for the first time was insanely high. I remember just leaning over to a friend of mine at one point. I can't even remember when it was. I think it was when she comes back to the house somewhere in the second act and she's covered in the blood of Doogie Howser.
I can't remember his character name, but I know exactly who you mean. And of course, we should say once again, sorry if you've got this far, there will be spoilers.
When she just comes back covered in blood. I remember turning to a friend of mine and going, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how this is going to end. And just that sheer adrenaline of not knowing where something was going was just a buzz in my head. And also Fincher handling it like a pro at the top of his game. He's now made The Social Network. He's got that same sort of style of camera. The opening sequence, I remember immediately feeling unsettled. The credits fade in, and as they're fading out, we cut to a different shot just before that they faded out. So it's got this immediately unsettling, jumpy effect to it where something's not quite sitting right. And then I remember watching them fall in love in these like flashbacks that they have where he's wiping sugar off her lips and things like that. And hearing that the dialogue was very clearly dubbed and being like, what's Fincher doing? Like, this feels really weird and I'm not sure if I like it. And then you find out that all of that was an act and that it wasn't really real. And I'm like, oh, of course that's what he was doing. He was making me question it because I was going, there's something not quite right about this. And he knew that that was the effect it was going to have. And it did have that uncomfortable effect. And then later it made complete sense. I think everybody's amazing in it. Casting Ben Affleck as well in that role is, again, metatextually genius to do that. Some guy that's kind of likable, but also a bit of a sleazy bastard as well. Like, there's something about him that made sense. It all just works for me. And it's a joy to watch. I love it. I loved Gone Girl. And like I say, it's just pulpy and it's silly and it knows it. And Finch is kind of using all of it as a comedy in some ways. It's so good.
I think the minute you cut to the shot of her in the car, when it's the first version of, oh, it's not the version you think it is, I just thought, okay, I'm on. I'm on.
Yeah.
I'm on. And then as you,
Because in a worse film, that would be the ending twist. But he goes, nah, halfway through.
Well, it's not even halfway. I mean, it's a kind of weird. It kind of happens at a moment in the movie that you think it's gone too far to go this way, but not far enough for it to be the twist. And then suddenly,
yeah,
you go,
yeah.
What?
You're like, is this the ending sequence? Are we about to finish? It feels like. No, we've got so much more film
left. It's structurally so bizarre because it is like I know people always talk about a film doing this. They say a film pulls the rug out from under your feet, and I know obviously people will be familiar with the source. I wasn't, but I think even if you are, it doesn't matter because it's like watching a magician do a trick. You may know the trick, and you may even know the trick's done, but it doesn't matter. You love to watch it done, and I just remember that moment going, "Oh, this is great." This is just, I'm on board. And then consistently managing to do it. So there are later moments in the film when things happen quite spectacularly in a kind of Verhoeven-esque style, because there's a lot of basic instinct in that film. I mean, I know that you know, people sort of shy away from it, mentioning basic instinct as a good thing, but there is a lot of basic instinct in that film.
But I think that's totally right. I think he wanted to just make a silly, pulpy film, but he's still going to make it like David Fincher. So it's going to be shot beautifully and it's going to be structured in a really interesting way. He's going to have performances that are really earnest and taking it seriously. Like, the characters in the movie shouldn't know that they're in a silly situation. They should be reacting like this is really happening, but we all know this is a silly movie. Like, I think that's what he gets pitch perfect.
Yeah, it's just really good fun. It's really good cinema, and I really enjoyed it. And in fact, I went back and saw it again pretty shortly after seeing it the first time, just because of how much fun it was.
So you got to the bar around 11 today. Where were you before that, just to cross that off?
Well, I was home. I left at 9:30. I got a cup of coffee, newspaper. I went to Sawyer Beach and read the news.
Did you visit with anyone there?
Well, I mean, I kind of go to Sawyer Beach for the solitude.
So, your wife has no friends here. Is she kind of standoffish, Ivy League, rubs people the wrong way?
She's from New York. She's complicated. She's got very high standards.
Type A? Well, that can make you crazy if you're not like that. You seem pretty laid back. Type B. Speaking of which, Amy's blood type.
God, I don't know. I have to look it up at the house.
You don't know if she has friends. You don't know what she does all day. And you don't know your wife's blood type.
Sure, y'all are married.
I maybe it's type O.
Where are her folks? New York?
Yeah.
Can they get here in time for this press conference tomorrow?
Tomorrow? I have no idea. I haven't talked to them.
You haven't called your wife's parents
yet? I mean, you can't get a signal in this building. I've been in here talking to you.
Well, call them, please, Nick, now.
Fine. Should I know my wife's blood type?
Okay, so look, this brings us into the top three. We are motoring through this. And at three, for me, seven.
And okay, this is interesting. Number three for me is Fight Club.
Okay, so we're still not a million miles away because I had Fight Club at four.
I think we're going to finish in a very, very similar place. I think this is much, much more even than Nolan
was.
Yeah,
it is. Okay, so let's do Fight Club since we're both now. So for me, Fight Club was four. For you, Fight Club was three. You go first.
Fight Club is something that I discovered both late and early in my life, so that to the point where it had been parodied and it had been ripped off so many times that the first time I watched it, I knew what the twist was before it happened. And not because I knew the twist was that they're the same person, or, you know, that's the basic way of interpreting the twist, is they're the same person, but because it was done so much in horror films. And, you know, there was a time around 1999 to early 2000s where there was loads of twists about someone being the same person or having a voice in their head. Like, A Beautiful Mind is similar to that. There's lots of that sort of stuff. Questioning reality was a big thing in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I've never massively, massively enjoyed Fight Club until maybe this year. And it immediately shot all the way up my list as one of my favourite Fincher films. I always liked it, but I never got it, I don't think. And actually, as I've gotten older, and we'll get a bit personal on this podcast, why not? Strap in. Since doing like therapy and things like that, and looking into myself and being interested in psychology and the way that personality works, like looking into Jungian psychology, and I know enough stuff has been said about Fight Club and Jungian psychology until the cows come home. Like, I'm not going to be the first nor the last person to make this comparison. But as soon as I was more clued in on things like that, There's an idea in Jungian psychology of the ego, which is the thing that you want to present to the world. And then there's the shadow self, which is the stuff that you learn from an early age that you're told not to do. So sexual stuff, like anything that would be deemed not worthy of public facing personality, you put that into the shadow. And good stuff can go into the shadow, like your aggression can go into the shadow. You can think that that's a bad thing to do, but actually being aggressive can show that you are, you know, not to be taken seriously in a situation, not to be aggressive, not to lose your control, but to be able to do it in a healthy way, to integrate it. Anyway, and I think there's a lot of exploration of that in Fight Club. I think all of it is just that. Jack, or the narrator, is at a point in his life where he is completely separated from that side of his personality. He's put it so far away that he's become this dull, boring pushover of a person. And in order to break that out, his personality splits almost and becomes a separate person. And this time watching it with that in my mind made it so much clearer, because it's not even trying to hide that it's doing that. The whole place takes place in an abandoned house, and when you see Tyler Durden, he's in the basement of the house. I mean, all the imagery for that is very obvious about what that could represent in terms of a psychological approach. And then there are things as well, like you have to destroy that part of yourself in order to be able to, like, there needs to be the death of it in order to integrate it. Like, all of that is there, and I just think it's mind-bogglingly entertaining as well, and knows exactly what it's doing. There's a moment when Brad Pitt does there's a lot of very famous speeches, but the bit when he goes, we all thought we were going to be growing up to be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. And you're like, that's Brad Pitt saying this to Jared Leto. So it's like he knows on another level what he's saying as well. And there are things in it that stuck out to me more on this watch. You know, this is a few months ago now when it started to like really, really click, was like the moment when he's with his boss and, you know, when he beats himself up and we watch him do it. For a long time, I thought he was conscious of that. I thought he was consciously doing it because he knew it'd get himself, like he'd get his boss fired. And I watched it this time and I realized, no, he doesn't know. He thinks that his boss is really beating him up. And that's what was scary about it. He was so foreign. The idea of that side of himself was so completely separate that he truly believes in that moment that his boss is beating him up. And there's even a freeze frame on that moment when he says, this reminded me of my first fight with Tyler. And then he smashes through a bunch of cabinets. And so, yeah, it just meant a lot more to me this time around. And I think that Fincher's way of telling you that it's all in his head is, from the very start, like you have it, the opening credits are going through a brain, and then even later as well, like in terms of meta humor again, there's a bit when he goes, can you think of anything, and he goes, still can't think of anything. He goes, huh, flashback humor. Like there's a lot of that, and obviously there's all the splicing in of the penises throughout the entire film, all the bits of the flashes of Tyler. Yeah, I think it's really, really good, and I don't think there's anything I can say about it relating to the psychology of human beings and the duality of man that hasn't been said, but I like all that stuff.
The only thing I would add to that is I think it's really funny. I mean, I think it's his best comedy, and I think it gets funnier. And I remember when, again, this is to do with an age thing, when it came out, it was the subject of some scandal. There was, you know, a lot of worry. Yeah, really? Oh yes, it's gonna be terrible. And then there were certain things that, you know, there were censorship issues, both in the UK and in America. And there was a lot of discussion about glamorizing violence and, oh, it's gonna cause people to do this, that and the other. And then you see the film.
I think it's such an interesting thing as well, because it's clear. I mean, the criticism of capitalism is another thing that's been talked about to death with Fight Club, that there isn't a shot in it without a Starbucks cup in it. But I also love the fact that we meet what's his name in the film, but it's played by Meatloaf.
The second thing I was going to say is the second thing I was going to say is I think it's Meatloaf's best performance. And I'm a fan of Meatloaf anyway. Yeah. I think Meatloaf in Rocky Horror is just great. Although in the film, obviously, he's only in it very briefly. But I've got a real fondness for Meatloaf. And of course, he came from theatre rather than rock music. I mean, he was always a singer, but he came from theatre. And I think he has brilliant comic timing. And I think that whole thing about the portrayal of, you know, emasculated, in inverted commas, manhood, and him playing a character who, you know, whose body is literally revolting against his sexuality, against his gender. And this is at a time when, you know, people, it wasn't perfectly fine for movies to do that kind of thing, to have those kind of discussions. And I think it's really interesting now, when you look at, one of the things that I think is, has been most positive about the last few years is that definitions of gender have really changed in the public perception. I think now people are much more aware of the fluidity of gender than they were a few years ago. Or certainly, because I think that it's just people, I mean, it's not that it hasn't been like that for a long time, but people have kind of woken up to it. But one of the weird things about Fight Club is that that whole sense of, you know, yourself and your body being in conflict is in, it's in Fight Club. And it is, it's a sort of excoriating portrait of manliness and maleness in crisis. But at the same time,
that's what I was going to say, is that I think that that moment, Bob's character, that's his name, Bob. It just literally came to me when I wasn't thinking about it. Bob's character in it, it also to me feels like what you were just getting at, which is the criticism of masculinity, and that he's accepting that in order to get through this thing that is so, you know, devastatingly that's happened to him, he's actually embracing femininity and sharing feelings, and he's in this space where he's crying openly and embracing people. And he also, in terms of metaphorically, he has boobs, so he has something of femininity literally on him. And actually then later in the film he says, I found something better, and that turns out to be a fight club. So he feels better after punching men in the
face.
If that's not a criticism, I don't know what is.
That's exactly what I mean about it's one of the funniest films, you know, because those things, because, no, because those things are, it's a, if you, even when you explain that, it's a gag, and it's a very, it's a pointedly funny gag, but it's a gag with a point. It is about deconstructing masculinity and deconstructing that gender identity thing. And in the end, absolutely scathingly laughing at the idea of the constructed macho persona, but
and getting Brad Pitt to play the ultimate man.
Jeez.
And then Brad Pitt himself looks at an underwear advertisement at one point that he would be on and probably has been on, something like that, and just says, is that what a man looks like? And is just constantly like this weird conflict with what he's saying and who he is.
But all that stuff is funny, and then at the end, you know, when the thing happens, that's funny as well. And you're actually thinking, I actually can't believe this. It's so wrong that this is funny. It's so completely wrong. And of course, actually, the whole thing about the way in which it's done is, I mean, I think anybody who takes that end literally is not watching the film. But it is, you know, it is that kind of, that, you know, the glorious anarchy of comedy, which is that you say the unspeakable thing and you make it funny. So I think Helena Bonham Carter is absolutely brilliant in that movie. I mean, I'm a huge Helena Bonham Carter fan anyway.
I think it's my favourite performance from
her. Yeah, I think it's, I mean, it's certainly the most daring thing that she's done, but I mean, I just think she's, you can imagine being David Fincher going, this film is really out there. It's really, we need somebody who's really, is Helena Bonham Carter busy? You know, it's
I'll say one more thing about Fight Club that I noticed this time that I really appreciated, which was that Tyler Durden, I think, demonstrates the parts of the narrator's, you know, resentments throughout the film as well. Like things that you don't need to say, but you learn about the character if you pay enough attention. And I think he's extremely angry at his dad. I think he's so devastated that he didn't have a father when he was young. And there's moments in it when Jack, the narrator, says, oh, you know, my father left when I was young. I didn't really know my father. Like, he just sort of brushes it off. But Tyler's really angry at his dad. Like, he's just got this thing throughout the entire movie about how much he hates him. And there's even a speech, another very famous speech, where he says something like, our fathers were models for God, And if our fathers abandoned us, what does that tell you about God? Like, he's constantly just, like, furious at his dad, and he's blaming everything on him. But they never address it. It's just, like, sprinkled in. And I think that's really good character work, that they know exactly where Tyler's coming from the entire time. And it's just this petty little thing that he hasn't worked out, that he's really angry at his dad.
What do you want me to do? You just want me to hit you?
Come on. Do me just one favor.
Why?
Why? I don't know why. I don't know. Never been in a fight. You?
No, but that's a good thing.
No, it is not. How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? I don't want to die without any scars. So come on, hit me before I lose my nerve.
Oh, God. This is crazy.
So go crazy. Let her rip.
Hey, I don't know about this.
I don't either, but who gives a shit? No one's watching. What do you care?
Wait, what? This is crazy. You want me to hit you?
That's right.
What, like in the face?
Surprise me.
This is so fucking stupid.
Into the top two. So my number two is Zodiac. You had Zodiac at number...
I had Zodiac at number five.
Okay. What's your number two?
My number two is Seven.
Okay, fine. So I had Seven at number three. So
I'm also so pleased with what the number one is. Of course it is.
Of course it is. Okay, so let's do Zodiac first. I'll go first on this. The reason I love Zodiac is because it's that thing about it's the anti-procedural procedural. It's a film that is about procedure, and yet it isn't about procedure. You get the sense because of the whole way of the kind of the mythology of the Zodiac case, which, as we know, you know, had made its way into the movies even before the case was, you know, anywhere near being sort of finished. And of course, you know, I'm a huge fan of William Peter Blatty's Legion, and the Gemini killer in Legion is thought to, you know, to take some inspiration from the Zodiac case. But the thing about the film of Zodiac is it's not about that. It's about everything else. So it's a procedural that is actually about procedure, but at the same time, it is not about procedure. It is about everything else. And I think what's so clever about it is that it's like watching a movie deconstruct itself in front of you. It's like watching something actually stand there and deconstruct movie genres whilst it's telling its story. And it does it so deceptively that you have no awareness of the fact that it's doing it. I think it's a really clever...
Like, what springs to mind when you think about that? When you think about it deconstructing movie genres whilst telling you its own story, what's springing to your mind in Zodiac for that?
I mean, like, for example, you think from the title of the film and the subject matter of the film that it's going to be a film about the Zodiac. Okay, you think it's going to be, you know, the Zodiac is a real life killer, and we all know about the mythology of this, and it isn't. And then you think, okay, well, what it's going to be about is it's going to be about the case for hunting down the Zodiac. And you know, narratively, that is what it's about. It's about this case going cold and then not being let go. But it isn't about that either. And then there's a moment when the case kind of gets solved so incidentally that you almost don't notice that it's happened. And then the film keeps going. And it's like the film is going... That's not what this is about. And it's all done. It's visually beautiful. And because one of the things that Fincher really understands, you know, Brian De Palma always says, I'm the only Hitchcockian director. And you go, well, being Hitchcockian is not just to do with, you know, having shots that do this and shots. Hitchcockian is a kind of, it's to do with attention.
Not just a canted angle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's to do with tension in the narrative. And I think that Zodiac is a brilliant example of the tension is not in solving the crime. The tension is not in the crime. The tension is in the narrative, which is always one step ahead of you. I've seen Zodiac four times now, and every time I forget which way it goes and at which point. There's a point about two-thirds through Zodiac when the film seems to have stopped. I mean, the film literally seems to have finished, and yet... The central character, one of the central characters, they're in a central, is so obsessed that it kind of goes, oh, all right, and then it kind of gets up and carries on going.
Yeah, I think so, that it knows that you're going into it being like, okay, this is a very famously unsolved case. So it could be anyone. And so from the beginning, am I right in saying that a lot of the murders in the first hour or so of the film are filmmaking interpretations of real police files?
I, as far as I understand, yes, it is. It is factually very, very on the money. And usually, when that happens, there's a horrible element of exploitation in it. You know, and I mean, we've seen enough serial killer movies, you know, in, particularly in recent years, as it happens, which do that kind of, you know, true. This is like actually being at the crime. Yes. And yet the really impressive thing about Zodiac for me is that that's not the point. Well, it's almost as if they've gone to such trouble to make sure that all the frame... You know this thing about... I don't know whether you've ever watched The Crown on television, but one of the things about The Crown, they cost like $1 million an episode. And one of the things they do is that they have all this kind of historical research. Obviously, all the sort of personal conversations are made up, but the actual factual stuff has to be right. So they go and get the documents. So when the Queen is signing documents, they make sure that they've seen the actual documents, and the stuff that she's got in front of her is a proper replica of the proper documents that she properly could be signing, so that no historian could go, oh, well, that's the wrong quill, or that's the wrong thing. But actually, the story is about the royal family, you know, and their interactions. In the case of Zodiac, it's like they've gone to the trouble of putting all the structure, framework, in exactly the right place, and organising all the furniture and organising all the details, and then going, okay, anyway, the film is, you know, then going
yeah,
off.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Like, I love that it starts out with this murder. It's almost like a opening scene, like before the credits hit in a TV show or something. It's like shows you one Zodiac killing, and it's the girl who suggests that they go somewhere quieter and then is nervous when she sees somebody there. I think she even goes like, oh no, or something like that. And then when he drives away and comes back, she's like, she knows what is kind of going to happen. And there's lots of implication in the film that, or lots of hinting that Zodiac could be anyone. And it almost at first it's like, oh, is it going to be that she's the killer? Or no, that she knows what's going on. Oh, she's dead now. What was that about? Like, there's a very strange like mood setter at the beginning where he's sort of telling you, look out for anything in this, because I'm going to be playing with you constantly about who or what is going on.
But that scene is particularly interesting because on the one hand, it's got all the problems of, oh my God, is this going to be an exploitative drama? And on the other hand, it's got exactly that thing of, it's not about that, you know. So you come out of that scene, and you're completely confused. You literally come out of it because and again, this seems like a weird thing. There's almost a comedic thing happening in that. There's almost a comedic thing happening in the going away and the coming back, which is really unsettling, really, really unsettling.
And I like that as well because I know that what Fincher likes about serial killer stuff is that there is a performance to this. We'll discuss this more when we talk about Seven, but when people are doing this, they're doing it because they like it and they're not doing it for any other reason. And all of Fincher's serial killer characters are all of his characters that are passionate about something, they are doing it because they like it. And he knows that when he has that car drive away, he knows that he's creating tension in somebody. So when he comes back, he knows it's going to be even more... They're going to be even more frightened because they thought they were escaping danger, but they aren't.
Sergeant Mullenix.
Sergeant Paul Avery from the San Francisco Chronicle. I just want to check if you had an unsolved firearm-related homicide on Christmas and maybe one on July 4th.
Shit. You guys got one, too.
Confirmed. VPD, they confirmed the shootings.
Al's on the phone with the examiner. They got the same letter with a different code.
Closer to the Times Herald. Christmas, two teenagers on Lover's Lane, both DOA. David Faraday and Betty Jensen. July 4th, Darlene Farron and Michael I think it's Mayhew. Anyway, he lived. She didn't.
The murder weapons?
Ballistics. Everything he said in the letters matched. I mean, I think the Times Herald's going to go in it.
The examiner's going, but won't go front page. I say let's go front page. If he kills 12 people, it's not our fault.
Robert! We need the car, too. You're not finished?
No, I'm finished, Carol. I'm finished. Terrio's still here.
Really?
The first edition is off the floor in 10, Charles.
Give us a sec. Okay, replay. We'll go on page 4. What do you say, 20 bucks, whoever cracks the psycho's name?
He won't keep his name.
Morty's? Anyone? Where I'm heading.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So Jack, since you brought it up, so now let's do seven, because I think the joy of this is we're both on the same page at number one. So seven, she want to go first or me go first?
I watched it again last night, so it's very fresh in my head, and okay. I don't know how many times I've seen seven. It's got to the point now where it's definitely, you know, in the 20 somethings, if not more, because I've probably just had it through most of my life and always thrown it on. I think it is a work of genius. I don't think there's a foot wrong in the whole film. I genuinely don't even know where to begin talking about it, because I just think it is an out and out masterpiece. It knows exactly what it's doing the entire time. It has you in the palm of its hands. It has that meta cinema thing, and I noticed it more this time, where Morgan Freeman literally says at one point, you know there's going to be no satisfying conclusion to this. You know that, like, he's just a man. It's not going to be anything. He's not a monster. And then the film gives you one of the most satisfying conclusions. So it almost reaches out to you and goes, just settle your expectations, all right? And then it blows your expectations away with that amazing final scene, again, that's been parodied to hell. But everyone's so good in it. It sets it all up beautifully. No one sees it coming who hasn't seen it before. It is such a brilliant combination of crime, horror, thriller. The performances are great. It all makes sense. I think it was, and correct me if I'm wrong, it felt like the beginning of movies like this where the villain is making a point. Like, he's making a larger artistic, dramatic point about something, and that is absolutely, like, you can see the knock-on effect with other movies that have come after it, like The Joker, like him, you know, We're Not So Different, You and I, that type of stuff feels like it's all started from here. And I love the behind the scenes story that I'm sure you know, that Brad Pitt said he wouldn't do it if they didn't have the ending the way that it was, because they were planning on changing it because they thought it was too gross and too gruesome and
not fun enough.
Too pessimistic. Yeah, too pessimistic. So they were going to change it to like the dog's head or something like that. They were just going to change it to lots of different stuff. And Brad Pitt was accidentally sent the script where it was Gwyneth's head. And he's like, I'm not doing it unless this is the ending. So the reason why it all happened the way it happened is because of complete circumstance, that he was as powerful as he was at the time that he was. I think it's perfect in its genre. It cannot be replicated.
Well, of course, the most perfect thing is that you never see what it is anyway. And so the joy of it is it could be whatever they want it to be. And that's the real genius, is you know exactly what it is, but they don't show it to you because you don't have to.
And they've shown you so much stuff throughout the entire film that there's constantly a tension that you're going to see Gwyneth Paltrow's horrible, disfigured, decapitated head.
Yeah. But you don't, you know. And that's the, I don't know. I think it's really, really clever that you don't ever, you know, you just, it plays on his reaction. So the two things I'd like to say about it is, I saw it when it first came out. Again, I'm a lot older than you, and I think it's possible to forget this now. I was really shocked by how nasty it is. I mean, I'm a, you know, a hardened horror fan, but I was really shocked. I mean, the knife attachment is one of the most grotesque things. I think to some extent, because, you know, what came in the wake of it, I mean, you know, you mentioned Joker, the elephant in the room here is the Saw movies. I mean, you know, Jigsaw, kind of all that sort of, I'm here to prove to you the, you know, the moral grossness of the world. You go, yeah, fine. And I've seen all the Saw movies and fine. But
I'm not getting the point.
Well, the point, it really is, isn't it? I was absolutely shocked when I first saw Seven, because the nastiness of the crimes. I mean, the sheer. Although what you see is to some extent quite fleeting. I mean, you do see graphic stuff, but it's also kind of fleetingly graphic. You do. No, I know, but it's also kind of it. But it's shocking. It's genuinely shocking and horrible, because the thought of it is so horrible. The act, the proper, you know, genuine thought of it, and the nastiness. And
that's what I mean about, like, David Fincher's criticism of people who enjoy this stuff, because I think Morgan Freeman, from the beginning of that film, almost feels like he's above this sort of situation, the grossness of it and the exploitative nature of it and how horrible he thinks it all is. He's like above it and he doesn't like it. And even throughout the film, like the moment when they're about to go into Sloth's crime scene, which is a particularly horrible one, the SWAT team are about to break down that door and you just hear Morgan Freeman say, they love this. And then you watch them burst in and they go, move, 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 down on the floor, do this, do that. And you can see how much they're enjoying the adrenaline of it. But then the end of the film is that he chooses to stay there and do it because he's right. He's part of it. He loves it as well.
The other thing that, again, this is just to do with seeing it when it first came out, which is a long time ago now. There was a lot of stuff about what print of it you saw, whether you saw a silver retained print or not. And the print that we got shown in the preview screening was indeed one of the silver retention prints, in which the blacks were very black. Now, cinema technology has moved on so much nowadays that seems like less of an issue. But it was definitely true that when Seven first came out, there were the prints of it that were really expensive to produce. And there was, you know, it was done with this silver retention process, which meant that the blackness of the screen was jet black. And the idea was that it created the impression that you were peering through a broken frame into somebody else's world, almost. And the Fincher worked so hard on getting that right, but only a certain number of the prints, for a fairly small number, were processed with the silver retention process, which double washed it and did all this stuff. So it looked more remarkable in some prints than it did in others. And then when the film came to DVD and Blu-ray, Fincher was able to kind of correct it so that it looked more. So it was one of the weird cases when a film actually came out on disc and home viewing, you know, formats, in which it might be the first time you got to see the film the way the director intended you to see it. Which, again, I know this doesn't sound like a big deal now, but back then, I remember writing a piece about this for Sight and Sound and going, this is really unusual. The whole idea that you can control what the image looks like in a digital version of it. But there are prints, you know, you might have gone to see it at the Barnet Odeon and it was an ordinary, you know, an unspecial print that had run through a projector 50 times and was a bit crummy around the edges.
Yeah, that's just like the colour correction and the grade is such a normal part of the process now.
Yes,
you can actually even record things now on cameras where you can change the settings after the fact, whereas back then that was absolutely not an option.
But back then it was literally to do with the prints. It was to do with there was only a small number of the prints that were actually looked like what the film should look like. So there was like discussions, like I said, this is a long time ago. This is before the internet, okay? People would have discussions about which print was playing where. I mean, that's how mad it was. And And I know
because film buffs knew that they wanted to see the one.
You wanted to see the right print, yeah. And it was, and there weren't that many of them because they were expensive to produce. I know this now sounds like, you know, hooey and baloney, but believe
me. No, it doesn't. It sounds very interesting. Like, what a different way of doing it. Like, that would never happen now.
No, it wouldn't. And it was a thing. It was like, so which screening were you at? Oh, you were at that preview screening. Yeah. Well, that preview screening.
Well, it kind of reminds me actually of like when Tarantino released Hateful Eight. And there was only a certain
which
amount
version of
cinemas
of it
that would show it on 70mm. Yeah,
exactly. So it was the format of it was as much of an issue as there. And I, so from just the point of view of looking at the film and it being an unbelievable film to look at as a piece of, as a physical creation of an artwork, it had so much work had gone into it, and then it was so nasty, and then the music was remarkable. I mean, the way in which the soundtrack, you know, was... I mean, I think for many people that will have been the first time they ever heard, you know, Bowie's, you know, Filthy Mess, and quite extraordinary. And then...
The Nine Inch Nails song as well over the opening titles.
Yeah. And then the fact that at the end of it, when they go out into the bright sunlight and you literally feel like you're being dazzled by that last sequence, which is where the thing happens. and everyone's kind of almost going like that because the cinema's been so dark for so long.
Do you know some of the like beautiful like little Easter eggs? I'm sure you know loads of them, but like all those poles, all the in the final desert scene, they're all shaped like sevens. There's sevens everywhere.
Oh. No, but
so
that hadn't occurred to me. That is brilliant. And then finally, because we should raise this, it's the Kevin Spacey issue. You know, obviously Kevin Spacey is persona non grata now as a result of stuff that's emerged about his personal life. And people always ask, you know, the question about, well, what does that then do to the art? I'll tell you what it does to this particular piece of art.
Yeah.
What it does for me,
a bit, doesn't it?
No, I was going to say what it does is I completely forgot about it while watching the film again, because the film is
right.
I had it in my mind, you know, I wonder how this looks now, because I don't think I've seen a Kevin Spacey feature film since all this stuff broke. Baby Driver, I think, was the last thing I saw him in, which was before all these stories broke, and I was going back to watch Seven because I haven't seen it for a long time, and I remember thinking, I must ask myself that question about, you know, I never thought about it once. I just watched the film. And because the filmmaking is so extraordinary that you go, okay, the film is the film. I don't actually think about that being Kevin Spacey any more than I think about that being Brad Pitt and that being Morgan Freeman. I don't think there's a bit of Thelma and Louise, there's a bit of Shawshank Redemption, and there's that creepy bloke. I just think of them as the characters in the film.
So do I. Yeah, it's at that point, actually. And this is the first time, on a slightly different note, but still to do with who's playing them. It's the first time I didn't really like Detective David Mills very much. I think I've been blinded by the Brad Pittiness for a while, but I watched it this time and I was like, oh, he's a bit annoying, isn't he? Like, he's a bit like, got like young peppy energy. It's me and you, isn't it? Like, you're Morgan Freeman and I'm Brad Pitt.
I'll take that.
Oh god, he's annoying.
I'll take that.
Wait a minute, I thought all you did was kill innocent people.
Innocent? Is that supposed to be funny? An obese man, a disgusting man who could barely stand up, a man who, if you saw him on the street, you'd point him out to your friends so that they could join you in mocking him, a man who, if you saw him while you were eating, you wouldn't be able to finish your meal. And after him, I picked the lawyer, and you both must have secretly been thanking me for that one. This is a man who dedicated his life to making money by lying with every breath that he could muster to keeping murderers and rapists on the streets.
Murderers.
A woman.
Murderers, John, like
a
yourself.
A woman. So ugly on the inside that she couldn't bear to go on living if she couldn't be beautiful on the outside. A drug dealer, a drug dealing pederast, actually. And let's not forget the disease spreading whore. Only in a world this shitty could you even try to say these were innocent people and keep a straight face?
All right, Jack. So, look, that brings us to the number one spot, and we're on the same page for both of us.
Of course we are.
Well, you say of course we are. I'm slightly surprised, but I'm very pleased. So you go first. Why The Social Network?
The Search Network is tied for my favourite film of all time, alongside Back to the Future. It's a film that I saw that I feel like changed my life in some ways. Like, I watched it and I just got it instantly. And I remember, because I was in uni at the time when it came out, not many other people around me like knew why I loved it so much. There's something I've spoken about quite a lot to do with why I think it's so great. And it's zooming in on a scene and why I think all of the Social Network works can be seen in this one particular scene. And it doesn't feel particularly significant. It's not one of the scenes that you'd be like looking up online. It's not Andrew Garfield's big rant. It's not none of the monologues. It's not the it's raining outside scene. It's nothing like that. It's just a scene where Mark and Eduardo go back to the dorm room and Mark goes over to the fridge and gets out a beer for himself, and Eduardo goes over and gets out two beers, and that's not ever discussed in the whole scene. They're just chatting about something else. They're still chatting about Facebook or whatever it is, but the dynamic there just tells you everything about what's going on in this film. I'm out for me and I'm looking out for both of us. And it's just one of those things that's never discussed. And I think that is just pitch perfect directing and figuring out how to elevate something. It's why I think Chicago 7 and Molly's Game to an extent aren't elevated films, is because I've seen somebody say this is not my thing, but I think it's perfect that Aaron Sorkin is too good of a writer to be working with Aaron Sorkin as a director.
Yeah, well, I agree I agree with that.
Of course, yeah. David Fincher, I think, went through this script with a fine tooth comb and figured out exactly what every single line was about, what the intention was. He is known for being a specific director, and you can see in the behind the scenes footage of The Social Network how they created new ways of shooting this film. It was shot on Red, which I think is digital. I'm pretty certain it is a digital only format, and they shot things like side by side so they could like have an impossible camera move go between two cameras on one of the opening sequences. It's the fact that before they made it, the script was about 150 pages or something like that, and David Fincher was like, this is a 2-hour film, and the studio were like, we need you to cut some pages off this, and he was like, oh, I'm not going to do that because I think it's perfect as it is. I'm going to have Aaron Sorkin read it end to end, and I'm going to time it, and that's going to tell you how long the film is going to be. And it was exactly 2 hours on the dot, and the film is 2 hours on the dot, and I have the screenplay. Hang on. I have the screenplay right here.
Very good.
And I've read it, and it is basically the film. And you might be listening to this being like, of course it is, it's a script. That's not the way it works. A lot of the time, what's written in a script doesn't get adapted the way it is. Things feel different when you get them on their feet. But this film is basically, word for word, the film that Fincher has made. And it blows my mind. Honestly, every time I watch it, it just is perfect. It's a perfect film. One thing I'll say now is that the twin CGI hasn't held up as much as you might think it might. If you watch it now and you really look at it, but that doesn't really matter.
Okay,
who cares?
Please
take it away.
No, so I just like to add, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I think the three things are important. Firstly, since you just raised it, the twin CGI for me was a perfect example of technology in being used in the service of the story, because I didn't know who Armie Hammer was and I didn't know it wasn't people. I thought it was two people.
So you wouldn't be looking for it before it was Armie
Hammer. Looking for it. I thought it was two people, and then somebody went, no, it's not. And I went, I mean, bear in mind, Dead Ringers had already happened some years before and had demonstrated that you could do this. But in Dead Ringers, I knew there was only one Jeremy Irons. I didn't know how many Armie Hammers
there
were.
Jeremy Irons.
But that's it. So when I was watching Dead Ringers, which was amazing, I mean, it just like, oh my God, that's really amazing. And I was watching, it never occurred to me that it wasn't two people. It never occurred to me that it was a doubled up Armie Hammer. Secondly, there's the weird bit suddenly halfway through when you're in the middle of a rowing race and the film literally goes, what? It's so bizarre.
Set to the Hall of the Mountain King.
Yeah, the other thing is, as being the person that I am, who has a fundamental distrust of Facebook, it managed to engross and entertain me.
It's aged well, hasn't it?
Yeah, it managed to engross and entertain me about a subject about which I could care less. And I thought that was really good, because I've always said the mark of a great documentary is a film that can interest you and educate you about a subject that you don't know or care about before you watch the film. And I think, although...
Well, I think it's because The Social Network is dealing with like classic, dramatic, Shakespearean themes. It's like about friendship and betrayal and business.
It's not a documentary. It is about those things, but it's also, I mean, obviously there are inventions in terms of everything that happens between him and the relationship with his girl. You know, there is clear invention. But it doesn't matter because the story isn't it. But I tell you the thing that I think, and I, you know, I love the dialogue. I love Jesse Eisenberg. I mean, in a way, the issue is that I don't know that Jesse Eisenberg has ever been that good again, because I don't know that Jesse Eisenberg has ever been cast that perfectly again. Yeah. That kind of
he was
sense
great
of,
in Zombieland, and he was great in this.
Yeah, but it's just the perfect role. But the thing that really struck home for me was some time ago, somebody, my son, showed me a video on the internet of a speech that Zuckerberg, the real Zuckerberg, gave, in which, and you'll know this, he famously slipped. He was talking about how people think that Facebook was run in a way that was kind of, you know, all algorithmic and didn't really have any heart or compassion. And he said, look, I understand. I am human. And it was this.
I haven't seen that. That's so funny.
It's a glitch in the Matrix, you know. And and because of what I understood from the character in Social Network, I just laughed for ages about that.
I used to be human.
So it's just that thing about it told me a story that I remember thinking, this is a story, the invention of fucking Facebook, people sitting, I mean, because
that was it. Like, I remember people being like, the Facebook film.
I know, like, and like, I mean, nah, you know, you and I talked about Hackers. I know you're not a fan of Hackers, but I love Hackers, and one of the reasons
it was fine.
But one of the reasons I loved it was like, Hackers, what, it's a film about people doing this, and then it wasn't. And in the same way, Social Network, what, it's a film about people doing that, and it wasn't. And also that I think Garfield is brilliant. I think Andrew Garfield is brilliant.
He's amazing. But I know he won a Kermy Award, didn't he?
He did. Well, yes, he did. Well done, Jack. I'm amazed that you. Yes, he did.
I know my history.
Yeah, well, and I am indeed history. But the just that thing about to have a film in which the central character is so fundamentally unlikable, and yet the drama makes you interested in and invested in what happens to him. And I think it is a really good example of that. You don't have to be likable. The character does not have to be likable. The character has to be interesting. And
And it's also the way that it's told to you as well, because David Fincher knows how to give you this story. And I want to talk about specific stuff, like the opening, not the opening, but one of the opening sequences in it when they're making Face Mash, and it's just a bunch of guys. He's just tipping away on his keyboard. There's a couple of guys getting stoned behind him, and they infiltrate these high, you know, stakes parties within college that they're not invited to, but they find a way to infiltrate them through making these websites, and then control their evenings and control their social. And that's exactly what the film is about.
Yeah.
It's just captured in this little moment where it's intercutting between him creating Face Mash and these sexy college parties, and he manages to control all of it from his bedroom. And it's just like, there you go, that's the film. That's what he's doing. That's what the whole conclusion is going to be.
And there's also, you know, there are great things, that thing about, you know, the internet being written in, you know, in ink or whatever it is, about the idea that it's not ephemera. This is something that is going to stay around for ages. Funnily enough,
you write your snide shit from a bedroom, from a dark room, because that's what the angry do these days.
But I remember watching, and this seems like a strange connection, watching Notting Hill, in which one of the best bits in Notting Hill is the bit when Julia Roberts says, he says, oh, but it's, you know, they've got these pictures. It's all right, it'll be gone. And she says, no, they won't. No, they won't. They will be there forever. And that that idea about, right, you know, about stuff being there for, about the permanence of transience, I think is really brilliantly done. And plus it's really funny.
Let's talk about the amazing soundtrack as well.
Yeah.
By Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who I mean, they thankfully won the Oscar for it, because this film, I think,
in a rare case of the Oscars getting it right.
Yeah. Well, in an Oscars where they got it very wrong and didn't give David Fincher Best Director, and they didn't give him
Best Picture. Who did win Best Director?
Best Director was Tom Hooper, and The King's Speech also won Best Picture.
Oh, good Lord, I'd forgotten
boring.
That. Wow, that's a decision
what
that hasn't aged
boring
well.
Boring choices. I know, right? Right? The director of Cats beat out David Fincher at the Oscars for The Social Network. Awful.
Jack, that is shocking.
I know. Yeah. But the score by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, I think, is a genre shifting, and I mean movie soundtracks, like in general, like shifted the way that soundtracks were made after The Social Network.
Yeah, I think.
Hans Zimmer's also got something to do with that. But there's no way that we would have had the amazing, bizarre tips and clicks and beeps that we got in Into the Spider-Verse by Daniel Pemberton if it wasn't for Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross doing it for The Social Network.
No,
like, the way that that score was made is so different from anything else you'd ever heard before it. And it's just also, just on a personal note, perfect to do your work to. You feel like you're doing something important when you listen to that soundtrack and you're working on something that you're doing.
Yeah.
It really pumps you up.
You signed the papers. You set me up. You're gonna blame me because you were the business head of the company and you made a bad business deal with your own company. This is gonna be like I'm not a part of Facebook.
It won't be like you're not a part of Facebook. You're not a part of Facebook.
My name's on the masthead.
You might want to check again.
It's because I froze the account?
You think we were gonna let you parade around in your ridiculous suits pretending you were running this
company? Sorry! My Prada's at the cleaners! Along with my hoodie and my fuck you flip-flops, you pretentious douchebag!
Security's here. You'll be leaving now?
I'm not signing those papers.
We will get the signature.
Tell me this isn't about me getting into the Phoenix. You did it. I knew you did it. You planted that story about the chicken.
I didn't plant the story about the chicken. What's he talking about?
You had me accused of animal cruelty.
Seriously, what the hell's the chicken?
And I'll bet what you hated the most is that they identified me as a co-founder of Facebook, which I am. You better lawyer up, asshole, because I'm not coming back for 30%. I'm coming back for everything.
It is an interesting thing. I had completely forgotten that's okay. I'm just going to play you this, Jack. I'm going to play you this down the phone, okay? So hang on.
But it is going to bother you because you're human, and I was human. I am human, but I was just referring
to... You hear that?
Oh my God, that is so bizarre!
Isn't it great? I'm going to play it to you again because it's the glitch in the Matrix moment. Here we go. The voice of Mark Zuckerberg.
But it is going to bother you because you're human, and I was human. I am human, but I was just referring to myself in the past.
Oh my God!
There we go.
And I was human.
I am human. and the point is that would not have meant anything to me had I not seen Social Network, because you know, so. And what you're saying about the clicks and bumps of the things, it's almost like the soundtrack knows that.
Yeah. So this is actually one of the things that's different in the script. I'll try and get the exact wording, actually, is that in the beginning, after they have that big argument in the bar, and then when she leaves, and then we have the beautiful opening title sequence of him going back to Harvard, and all that emotion that's in his head is just not, you know, is not coming out. He's just jogging back to his apartment, to his dorms. In the movie, it's this single piano sound, very famous dun dun dun, but with like a long groaning underneath all of it. In the move, in the script, I'm pretty sure it says something about like here we go. I'm pretty sure it says something about loud thumping music, and that was supposed to be what it was. Oh, hang on. Pulsing into Paul Young's Love of the Common People crashes in. That's very different, isn't it? That's one of the things that Fincher was like, nah, I'm going to I'm going to make it better than that.
And what's lovely is not even Love of the Common People, but Paul Young's Love of the Common People.
And also, isn't it interesting as well that at the end of the movie, Erica Albright is on Facebook. And that is just, it's just very interesting to me that the movie finishes in a place where, like, he's kind of won. Like, he's kind of, he's got her on the thing that he's created, but he's also alone and doesn't, and gains nothing from that. Is there anything else we can say about The Social Network that hasn't been said? It's amazing. It's a masterpiece. It's everybody's favourite film of the 2010s. Everyone knows now how good it is.
So look, let's do a rundown from 10 to 1 of our ordering. So for me, number 10, Benjamin Button.
Alien 3 by default, because I haven't seen it.
Number 9 for me, Alien 3.
Panic Room.
Number 8, The Game.
The Curious Case of Benjamin Button.
Number 7, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
The Game.
Number 6, Panic Room.
The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Number 5, Gone Girl.
Zodiac.
Number 4, Fight Club.
Gone Girl.
Number 3, Seven.
Fight Club.
Number 2, Zodiac.
Seven.
And number 1, Social Network.
The Social Network.
You know, it's actually surprising how much that's measured up. And we are...
It's kind of lined up well, hasn't it?
It has, and we are from completely different generations. You are from the... You are a digital native, and I am a, you know, whatever they call it, a digital incomer or whatever it is. We are literally from different generations, and yet we have ordered those films in very, very similar ways, which I think says...
I was so nervous that you were going to have some sort of... Yeah, like I say, a Dark Knight Rises moment again, where you're like, I think Curious Case is in the top three.
Stop referring to it as a Dark Knight Rises moment. You know, I have to tell you this. My son, who you know, was
yeah, he's been messaging me about that.
Did he? Oh, okay, I didn't know that. I was here in the... He was in the kitchen, and we were having the thing, and I came out, and I hadn't realised he was next door. He'd been... And he said, did you say what I think you just said? And I went, yeah. What? And he went, about that. I went, oh, you heard that? He went, yeah. And he was genuinely shocked. He was like genuinely shocked.
I think a lot of people who listened to that were shocked that you put The Dark Knight last in that trilogy. I think that is a bizarre stance to take.
The difference is, Jack, a lot of people that listen to it aren't my son. I don't mind anyone being appalled, but he's my son.
You'll never forget the look on his face that you put The Dark Knight last.
I will never forget the look on his face.
He texted me about it.
Yeah, well, you know, and in a way that...
Clearly
kind of,
very rattled.
That kind of makes perfect sense, you know. Oi!
I said, you can come stay with me anytime you want.
Yeah. Okay, well, Jack, that was really good. That was really good fun. We've run over. We've gone longer than we should have done. But I think it worked out well. And
we've kept people company in these trying times.
And I'm sorry, just because I think it's so perfect. I'm just going to sign off by saying, okay, if you've enjoyed this podcast, thanks very much for listening. You know, remember to subscribe, remember to do all the things that none of us ever knew about.
Send us a tweet. Let us know what you want us to discuss, if there's anything.
Exactly. I'd say go to the Facebook page, but I don't have one. Or if I do, I don't understand what it... Well, there we go.
If I do, I don't go on it.
Don't understand what it is, how it works, why it works, or anything like that. But I'm sure it's all fabulous. And go to our Patreon page. That's nice. It's got a video of me and Jack doing this. And I'm going to leave you with this.
It is going to bother you because you're human, and I was human. I am human, but I was just referring
to myself. Oh, it's the gift that keeps giving. So there we are. That was me and Jack Howard counting down our top 10 David Fincher movies in order. As I said, if you missed the first half of this podcast, don't worry. All the podcasts are available for you to download and listen to at any time. Thanks for listening to this Kermit on Film podcast. If you've enjoyed it, remember to subscribe, remember to tell your friends, and remember to keep watching the skies.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.